writer, the writer of Naked Lunch, David Cronenberg, made a movie out of it. You know, it's about a writer who shoots his wife. But one thing that they don't include in the film is that there's me. I'm the son of that union, and my father gave me the same name as him, so I could be Junior, so he could call me Junior. I was born in Conroe, Texas, in 1947, 4:10 a.m. My mother must have been an incredible woman, because during the entire course of my fetal development, she consumed enough Benzedrine daily to kill a buffalo outright. Whereas my father, Big Bill, he took 3 bangs of heroin a day to keep up with her. I was born onto an alfalfa farm in the Rio Grande Valley. The main crop was marijuana. It grew between the rows of alfalfa. My father would make a joke. He'd come up to the hired hand and he'd say, "Hey, Jose, what's that? What are those weeds doing growing in my alfalfa? Ha, ha, ha." We split for Mexico City almost immediately upon the moment of my birth. I don't have any memories of our apartment in the native quarter of Mexico City, except for blue walls along a spiral staircase. Hot droning of locusts that seed through gasoline fumes. The net over my crib beside a White House. Scorpions that battled between the roots of a gnarled tree. These memories, or reconstructed memories, they're flashes. Strobe-like. I remember I had never worn shoes a day in my life until a little white rabbit thumped up one of my brown and bare toes and then bit me like a Gila monster. I went crying to my mother. She was soft and warm and pulsing. And not only did I get a set of shoes, but I got a fresh can of beans. I had a half-sister named Julie, full of smiles, tiny naked dancer. She was my mother's daughter, only 2 years older than myself. We would laugh and play together. The first hint of disaster was an impossible, mad drive along sudden changing mountain roads. Terrifying glimpses of death in the window. Listening to my mother say, "Ha, ha, ha, how fast can this old heap go?" Me and Julia on the floor in the back in the intimacy of fear. Allen Ginsberg pleading with the driver, "Slow down, for God's sake, slow down." And then we hit something, and there was a little bit of blood, but not much. My mother, Joan was her name. She had soft brown hair and heart-shaped calves as seen from behind. Mama was tempestuous, to say the least. And that night, at a party in our home, where everyone was plastered and stoned, she put an apple or an apricot or a grape upon her head, or myself, and she challenged my father, who's usually an excellent marksman, to shoot. Accidental homicide. Cause of death, cerebral hemorrhage. Weapon, Colt 45. I have no memory of the apartment or of my mother. The past is a fiction, says my father, and I tend to agree with him. Allen Ginsberg told me one cold New York Chinatown night that my mother was a death freak, as is anybody who makes a habit of speed. He said that he had the morgue photograph if I wanted to see it. I said, "Maybe later." The photo was all the way across town. It was cold. Okay, the next thing I remember, okay. Only as much of me as I allow is there. Only as much of me as I care to dispatch. Okay. Now, I'm very sick in a rich woman's house, and I'm given a brutally cold bath, and Julie leads me up a winding staircase where up there she teaches me the best way to wash my hands. See, Billy, this is the best way to wash your hands, and that makes me feel glad. And then my father arrives, pale and haunted. He takes me to a park. We stand by a fountain, a big one that touches my face with spray. I'm nauseous, but I'm happy. By the water, he unveils his gift. It's a little red boat that runs on alcohol-soaked cotton that's ignited in the stern.
We have to be careful now, he says, as he lights the cotton and the boat chugs crazy circles on the water.
But my eyes are on the three teenagers who are staring at us from the other side of the fountain. They have greased back hair, and they're laughing at us, and I'm afraid of them.
So Julia, she went to New Orleans, and I went to...
My father made the wisest choice available to him, and he took me to live with my grandparents in St. Louis. I remember when I arrived... He left immediately. He stayed not upon the order of his going, but he left at once, wouldn't you? He was gone to suffer in abominable ways and to write naked lunch. I was taken in with great compassion. My grandmother, Laura Lee Burroughs, once extraordinarily beautiful, proud, aristocratic, possessed of a great strength and a great disgust of all things pertaining to bodily fluids. My grandfather was Moat, Mortimer P. Burroughs. He provided most of the merriment in the house. I remember I slept in the same room as my grandparents in that house in St. Louis because it was unspeakably horrible to be left alone in the dark. My grandmother would reach from her bed to mine and hold my hand. That's the type of thing that really endeared my grandmother to me, my sweet grandmother. I wouldn't have made it. I wouldn't have survived if it wasn't for that hand, reassuring me that whatever it was that waited for me outside in the dark would go away long enough for me to sleep. Later, they moved to Palm Beach, Florida, so I could grow up in a proper community. Moat was a dealer in antique furniture, and we lived in a house on Sanford Avenue, surrounded by the relics of a fictional past. And as I grew older, everything slowly came to be forbidden to me unless it was wholesome. The first two times my father arrived for a visit were very exciting times, driving to his hotel. He never stayed with us, but he favored the less expensive places at the beach end of Worth Avenue. Both times I arrived, he was standing in the hallway locking his door, me running to greet him into his arms, "Daddy!" And he smelled of cigarette smoke. He would come over for dinner. There was a general conspiracy in the family to convince me that Bill was an explorer, probably because of his South American sortie for Yage. You know, Yage? The third time he came, however, everything was different. I met him at the door with a ready embrace, but instead I encountered an uncertain handshake. I was 12 years old then. Imagine the scene. Stouffer's Restaurant, overlooking Lake Worth. Bill telling a story about the little monsters that lived downstairs from him in Paris. It seems that they'd cut their cat's head off using a garden shear. Bill found this most amusing. He was totally involved in his story, snapping his fists together in front of his face to demonstrate the action of the shears. Needless to say, my grandparents weren't very impressed by this, and he left the next day. But in the times between his visits, I was well brought up and cared for. I went to Palm Beach private school with Kellogg's and Dodge's and Post's. I once knocked Winnie Rockefeller onto his fat little ass, and my knuckles are still glinting because of it. When I turned 14, my father wanted me back. He was living in Tangier, Morocco at the time. Okay, the flight. My grandparents standing at the Miami Gate Airport, waving to the wrong window of the plane, while I, square, pink, 14 and American, I settle into my seat. I rifle through my science fiction anthology, and then there I am a couple of hours later in Lisbon, waving to an odd-looking man on the other side of the customs gate. And then we get onto another plane and off to Morocco. Moroccan customs officials were bored and indifferent. I mean, who would smuggle anything into Morocco, right? So we get into this cab, and we take this harrowing ride to this place called the Parade Bar. There were no streetlights in Tangier at the time, so every time the cabbies went through an intersection, it was like a deadly game of chicken, and every time we missed a hairbreadth accident, Bill would mutter a word of appreciation. bueno, like a calm bullfighter, even though the language spoken was French. So we arrive at the parade bar, and all these people who were going to hang out at our place in the Marchand arrive to shake my hand. An unaccustomed attempt at fatherly pride on the part of my father, and then I was alone and apart being accosted by an aging fag. I know I haven't lost my figure, darling. All the old tangerines knew you were coming, and we wondered what you looked like. Well, baby, if you ever want to get your nuts blown. I told him that I would tell him if it ever came to that, and I mean to say that the old fart was definitely not my type. And then after some rum and some dinner, we took another ride to our place in the Marchand. Inside, total disorganization. My father knew I was coming, but still he had to search the place with a flashlight to find a place for me to sleep because something had happened to the electricity. Wait for Ian, he said. And then Ian came home and fixed the electricity by going outside and hitting a power pole with a broomstick. Needless to say, I didn't sleep well that night. And I beg you to remember that the last time I had slept was on a mahogany bed in Palm Beach. When I woke up the next morning, I saw Ian sitting on the foot of my bed, staring at me like a loving mother. And then we talked for a while, and then ever so gently he took my hand and tried to draw to his groin. I pulled away. The attempt was premature. He didn't take it as hard as that old swish in the parade bar. And we were all friends that night when him and my father lit up their pipes, long pipes with clay bowls. And that night I had my first draw on the celebrated medicinal herb. Problem is, in Morocco, so many people smoke dope that they mix it with this tobacco that makes galwaz taste like ambulance oxygen. But luckily enough, my father had some tasty little hashish candies, of which I consumed quite a number of. And I can't even remember the onset.
The course of human history, ape-man, stream on the hostile plains, on through the Blessed Virgin, and plunging into the abyss of technology. Two ruined buildings, their backs blown away, naked girders grope in a smoking twilight sky. On the 10th floor of each building, leaning out the window, is a pale man with a sheet of metal. Below them, as far as the eye can see, is a multitude of people on their knees, some with flaming hair. They sway from side to side as the people in the building shake and crash the sheet metal.
Ian woke me up out of this dream with a concerned look on his face. When I told him what I'd seen, he went and talked to Bill. Bill was at work at the time. He was typing. He stopped long enough to say,
"Very accurate,"
and then he continued typing. Bill's room was austere, to say the least. There was just an army-type bunk and a cabinet, and that was all, except for an incredibly haunting picture of a brooding moon, done by his good friend Brian Geisen. The rooftops are, by custom, the woman's province in Tangier, and I made the mistake once of going up there during the day, and the Arabs threw little pieces of mud at my door for a week after that. But Bill would go up there every night and watch the colors of the sky changing. I would go up there sometimes, stoned out of my squash, to watch him. He would stand perfectly still, right hand always holding a cigarette, and only until it was finally absolutely night would he make the mad rush to the typewriter. There was also an Oregon box in the upstairs hall in which Bill would sit smoking kiff, and then again a sudden mad rush to the typewriter. Tangier was still pretty wild then. There was a little cafe on the cliff called the Dancing Boy. Smells of mint tea, hashish, kiff in the air, beautiful music. The violinist would sit cross-legged and play his violin in front of him like a cello. Sometimes we would stay there all night long, dancing and smoking, and then we'd go at 3 o'clock to some other place, one of the musicians' places, and we'd keep partying until everybody dropped, and then off to off to catch the fresh bread that was just being wheeled out of the barrel. To get a little bit of butter. These were pleasant times, but I couldn't make it because I was only 14 years old. And then one day, Ian came into my room, and he was crying, and he said, "You don't want to live in a house full of fags, do you?" And he told me I should go home, so I went home. And I went to school. And while I was there, Mope
died.
On a windy day,
palmettos trembled.
And the palmettos trembled.
From that time on, Laura's mind began to go, and after I graduated, I'd play guitar for her in the sunniest room of our house.
Up on Devil's Door, got a devil in my boy, that's a call daddy boy. Whack, whack, holding my mama's bag. Walk up, cause I don't give a fuck. They tried to lynch me and burn me and starve me, so I had to come back as Bob Marley and Marcus Garvey. I used to be Malcolm X. They thought they had me putting holes in my chest. Now I'm on the planet as a 1JRS. Now on the planet as a 1JRS. Ugliness continue summer after summer, cause the older generation teaches it to the younger. The trick is to outlive the older generation. Let the old ideas die with the old education. This is not the first time that I came to the planet. Each time I do, only if you can understand it. I came as ISIS. My words they tried to ban it, came as Moses. For people that was lost, I came as Jesus and they nailed me to a cross. They tried to lynch me and burn me and starve me, so I had to come back as Bob Marley. What you say when you got the devil down? What you say when you got the devil's crown? Stay alive, all things will change around. Stay alive, all things will change around. This MC goes for this. If you say fuck the revolution and shut the fuck up, I can't get with it. I'm gonna start a riot in a minute. You'll see so many folk that you're gonna think I'm British. What you say when you got the devil down? What you say when you got the devil's crown? Stay alive, all things will change around. Stay alive, all things will change around.